Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
Good morning. It is great to see all of you here. It's great to be back and to wrap up this series called Picture Perfect. Now, if you are have not been here the last few weeks, one is welcome. We're finished up a four-week series talking about the family, and it's talking about the family not like we're used to talking about the family. And today, as we wrap this up, you're going to have a lot more questions than you're going to have answers. But if you can really focus on one question, then I will have done my job. At least that's what I'm hoping to do, as just to really focus on this question about what God longs to and what it means. And my premise in this, if you're interested in like what I've taught about husbands and wives and all this, we've done lots of series. It's on our website, a series called Why Bother, Marriage Why Bother, a series called Parents Just Don't Understand, a series called Picture Perfect. It's, I mean, lots of them you can go, and if you're looking for that information, we'd be more than happy to share that with you. But I wanted to do something different in this series, and the reason is because a lot of times the teaching on the family is really centered on like mom, dad, 2.5 kids, and as long as that's perfect, you fit the mold. But what I've realized is that is not the condition of our culture. I don't know if y'all realize that or not. There are a lot of folks who come into these doors, and some of them are you, and you are sort of at the end of your rope. Maybe you feel like you've made mistakes that could never be undone, and somehow everything from this point on is going to be paying back what you've done. I talk to people all the time, their marriages are hanging by a thread, and they don't know what to do, or they've gotten a divorce, and it was a divorce that they didn't want, and it happened because of something that was done to them, or maybe you were the cause of the divorce, and it's something you did to someone else. There are people here who you wanted kids so badly, you had kids, and it's, and now you're pulling your hair out because of your kids. And some of you are here, and you want kids so badly, and you can't have kids, and you're like, God, what are you doing? And some of you are single, and you want to be married more than anything else. And it's just the, recurring thought. And we talk about, you know, husband, wife, and 2.5 kids. All of the rest of the folks are kind of left out. I think that's a mistake. I think that if anything, what has happened is we need to understand the family is more than what we think that it is and really explore this a little bit differently. So that's what I want to do, and I've tried to do in this series by asking you a couple of simple questions, and what does redemption look like? Today we're going to kind of expand our view and establish the fact that the frame that we use to talk about the family is really too small. That's what I want to talk about today. I hope that if you were here last week that you enjoyed Dr. James Banks. Did y'all love him? He was awesome, right? He was awesome. If you weren't here, you missed a real treat. Just sharing an incredible story about his own walk with his family and his son, and I just loved it. I was watching him online. We watched him at the 5 o'clock online. We were actually in a time zone 5 hours ahead, so it was about 10 o'clock p.m. we watched him, and I just loved the way that he just brought us all into this place where we felt like, man, it's really going to be okay, and I love what he said about the fact that, love never gives up. And for me, it was just a reminder, you know, that, man, what is it like to be loved like that by a father? And the truth is that we are. And I thought it was just such a great kind of breath for us. And so now you get me back today, and it won't be quite as, be more like a, instead of a nice breath. But the reason I wasn't here last week is we were over in London. We got to go to London last week, we went over for two reasons. One is we were meeting with Pastor Jackson, who is in charge, or who's our Kenya partnership over in Kenya. We've been in a partnership with him for 15 years, and it's been an amazing venture. Yeah, it's a great thing. Some of you don't even know. You need to go look online. We've got the story in there. It's an extraordinary story, extraordinary partnership. Great things have been done. And we were meeting in London. One is because it's a lot more central to get to London, so we could all sit down together and talk about the future and celebrate the past and talk about the future of our partnership. We had a great meeting with him, and we figured while we were there, we would do the tourist thing and take a few extra days and go doodle around London. It was awesome. We were on the double-decker buses and did the whole, we touristed as hard as you could tourist in London. It was super fun, but my favorite part was St. Paul's Cathedral. At least, it's a cathedral that was built, constructed, finished, I think, in 1675. And it is spectacular. You walk up to it, and you can just see it from the ground level, and it's got these two spires and the portico and the big dome. And you walk in, and it's just breathtaking. The ceilings are, I think the tallest point is 300 and something feet tall. And it's got a painting, like the Sistine Chapel, it's got a painting and a mural on the walls and the gold and the arches and all the history. And a lot of these churches, they have crypts underneath the churches where they bury their pastors. I was thinking, y'all don't get any ideas, right? It's like, it was like there's Mike right there underneath this thing. And they bury their pastors there. I'm not really sure if that's a good thing. You're done, we're burying you. But the history was magnificent. And then there's this place, as you walk through St. Paul's, and I studied architecture, so I loved this. I loved just, and one of the things we had done is in architecture school, we studied the history of architecture. We had to draw St. Paul's Cathedral. They had to like sketch it. And I've never seen this in person. I'm standing there going, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. And there's this thing they call the Whisper Gallery. And the Whisper Gallery is kind of like our balcony here, but it's a little bit better than our balcony here. You go back in this room and you go up these staircases and it winds in this sort of spiral, like you're going up this turret is what it's like. And it's, I don't know, probably 200 stairs and you're just up and it's getting smaller and smaller and tighter and tighter. And if you're claustrophobic, you start to freak out. You get to the top of the staircase as if that's not bad enough. And then there's a hallway and it's long and it's about as wide as my shoulders and about as tall as my head. And I was by myself for a long story, which is not always good for me to be by myself, but I was by myself. And I'm walking, and there's nobody around me. And so I'm walking along, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I thought about turning around 14 times, like, where am I? I'm lost in St. Paul's Cathedral. I'm never getting back to Wilmington. And you're just on and on and on and on. So they don't let me travel alone. They send somebody with me, a chaperone, to make sure I get back. And you come around this hall and turn, and you walk out, and you're in the Whisper Gallery. In the Whisper Gallery, you find yourself. You walk out, and you're in the bottom, the base of the dome, looking about 100 feet up. To the top of the dome, 150 feet up to the top of the dome, and about another 150 feet down to the floor of the chapel. And it's about 3 feet wide. There's a bench and then a rail, and it just takes your breath away. And I begin to notice all the detail and the intricacies of all this, and I thought, man, this is spectacular. And I began to think about all the little parts and how it got to be this way. And that's what I want to talk about today. This, how did this thing, this spectacular place in which God would meet with his people, how did that come to be? All the parts that get placed into this structure that caused it to be so magnificent and so splendid and people to look at it and go, wow, okay? So imagine you were back in the time of Moses. And you're at the service, and Moses is going to say, hey, Moses is getting ready to go. All the guys, all the people are coming together. We're going to hear a message from Moses. And so you all show up, and you're like, oh my gosh, there's Moses. There's the Moses, Moses. And you're like, there's Moses. And Moses begins his talk. And he says, hey, listen, guys. He said, I want you to hear, O Israel, that the Lord our God, the Lord is one. There's some commandments I want you to understand, to love the Lord with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind. I want for you to take these commands. I want you to teach them to your children. I want you to impress them upon them. I want you to do it as you lie down, as you wake up, as you eat breakfast, as you're in the drive-thru, as you're in the carpool, as you're at soccer practice, as you're at baseball practice, or whatever you do. As you go, I want you to teach these things, and you're hearing this. And you're all excited about God asking you to teach these things to your kids, and you go back and you say, I'm going to get me and my wife and my kids, I'm going to teach these things to them. And what I want to tell you is you become a brick. Now, bricks are good things. They can be good doorstops. I suppose they're good if you wanted to throw it at somebody if you're mad at them. But bricks in and of themselves aren't super helpful. And what I think we have done as a church, churches, as a culture, is we've elevated this idea of family to get you to be a brick. Get you, your wife, your marriage, your kids to well-behave, well-adjusted, and then, right, everything is done. And we don't realize that this is just a part. It's just a part. And it needs to be a part of something that it was intended to be a part of. You see, there were lots of parts in the details that made St. Paul's spectacular. And every single one of those parts and components came together in a certain way that allowed us to see what it was, what I got to see and experience, what we got to be a part of. I think the same thing is true for us as a family. When we think about the family, simply being you and your wife and your kids or your hope for that vision, you're simply a brick. We don't think about it outside. My question is, what if the family was more? What if it was more? What we've been talking about is the three unique things that the family does or contributes to culture. Number one is it contributes. It's the place where you find your identity. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. It's the place where you're given a name. If you want to know, and if you weren't here, this is what I believe the family's unique contribution to culture is. The family is the place where you are given a name, an identity. The second thing is the family is the place where authority is established. It's the first place where you learn that one human being has authority over another human being. It's the first place that's experienced. And thirdly, it's the only system in creation that builds or works toward a legacy. It has a generational calling to it, implied in its inception, in its creation, and its instruction. And so when you think about this, what I'm asking you, instead of thinking, how does God redeem your marriage and your kids, and you're going, I've already blown that, I want us to think about this as being more, because it's really, how does God redeem identity, authority, and legacy? That looks like a W. Identity. Perfect. I had spelling issues in the first service. So I want us to walk through this. Now, the passage we've been looking at the last few weeks is out of Ephesians chapter 1. And it says this. It says, in him, and this is talking about in Christ, in the context of your relationship to Christ, after listening to the message of truth, the gospel of your salvation, having also believed, this is important, having also believed, trusted, you were sealed with him with the Holy Spirit of promise, who is given as a pledge of our inheritance. There's a future thing coming. Who is given as a pledge to our inheritance, and that future thing is the redemption of God's people as his own possession. The future is this: God sees your life and my life with a view to the redemption when you fully belong to him and he gets the glory for it. That his name is your identity. That's the picture. Everything is drawing towards that. Everything in your life is moving toward that. And he sees you in your life to that end. So whatever you've done, he sees it to that end. Remember, redemption is really important to understand. Redemption is the reality that God uses everything. Redemption is the reality that God uses everything. And what we've been challenging you to do is you've got to start to think about, what does redemption look like in my life? That's the question. What does redemption look like in my life, in my story? And you will not see the new story until you let go of the old one. You will not see. Everybody has this picture of what we think God ought to do or what we would do if we were God. And sometimes you get that picture and you start to grab hold and you start to control it and manipulate it and try to make it happen. And you're not going to find God's new story until you let go of your old one. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. The family needs to be reframed in our culture. I grew up in the church. And we would often, at the end of services, we would hold hands. I think it was a Sunday night service we did this, if I recall. Sunday night services were always weird. We had a service in the morning and a service at night. I won't get into that, but we did this. And we would hold hands across the aisle at the end of the service. We would sing, I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God. I've been washed in the fountain and cleansed by his blood, right? And I remember thinking, like, man, this is a weird family. And so what happened over the years is I've never really thought of the church as a family. I think of the church as made up of families, but not the church as a family. So what you wind up with is a pile of bricks. I begin to wonder, what if there's more? Like, what if there's really more? What if you and I were able to think about this much differently, regardless of where we are with our families, regardless of the disappointment or where we are, whether we're where we thought we would be or hoped to be, or whether we're not there? What would it be like if God were really in the work of redeeming these things for something much more spectacular than just for you to have well-fed, well-educated, well-adjusted kids? Because isn't that kind of the idea that we grew up with? If we can just get our kids to behave, then everything will be okay. And what happens is, even this talk of family values in our culture, we need to bring back family values. If we're really honest about it, if you listen to the language carefully, what people are doing is, we need family values so we can build on this foundation of family values, not so God gets glory, but so that we can live the life that we actually want to live. That's idolatry. Using something that God intended for one thing in such a way that it becomes our source for something else is the definition of idolatry. When we looked at this, we said, what happens when identity gets replaced? It becomes idolatry. This is from a couple weeks ago. When authority gets replaced or undermined, we resort to power. We just force our will. And when legacy gets bypassed or when it gets undermined, we rely or we become just very much about the individual. We are all about the parts, the individual components, and we forsake the purpose of the whole. We just become a pile of bricks. And I wonder if we've done this and if there's some way we need to think about this that allows us to change it. So what I've done and what happens to us, the reason this is so important for us to understand is you can tell when you start to play in these types of, in this place right here, when we start to reject or to move further away from redemption. I just kind of put this in my notes to sort of frame the problem here. When identity is mostly demonstrated, becomes idolatry, when it is demonstrated by your performance. Whether you perform well at your job and you make a name for yourself, whether your kids perform well so they don't embarrass you, or whatever thing it is, that's a sure sign that you have started to create idols out of things and you're moving away from redemption. You're undermining redemption. Whatever authority, right? I'm trying to make sure I get this correct. Whenever authority becomes or becomes undermined and it becomes power, we depend on position. And for some of you, this is positions in your organization because you're someone else's boss. You tell them what to do and they should do it. For some of you, it's when you look at your kids and say, you do what I say because I'm the parent. You're starting to lord authority, you're starting to lord power over them and not leveraging authority. You're using your position. This is where cultures start to oppress other cultures. This is where all this happens, is when we use our position and our strength to keep someone else down or to push someone else down. It's a fundamentally an undermining or a movement away from the redemption of authority. And legacy, the idea here is that whenever you sort of move away from legacy, whenever legacy sort of becomes about the individual, what happens is we bypass a much needed perspective. For example, we have become so isolated in our culture about what we think about how we got to be the way that we are. Most people just think we live in a culture that's smarter and better and more advanced than other cultures. C.S. Lewis called this chronological snobbery. When I was in London, I saw all the stuff that happened, or even we were talking about this last night at the house. Like, who was the first person to discover that you could, you know, eat certain animals or do? I'm like, if it were me, civilization would be stuck because I ain't doing any of that. And we've all got to be the way we are because of something. I mean, think about this. In our culture right now, you have more information at your fingertips than any culture in the history of the world. You can, like, even right now, if you're bored with me, you can like go online and you can watch another pastor preach right now live somewhere else in the world and go, oh, Mike's no good. This guy's awesome. If Mike was this, would be awesome today. Put your headphones in. You can be texting people. You can be looking at people. Whatever you want to do. Why? Why do you have all this information at your fingertips? The reason is because you have an iPhone or an Android for some of you, right? You have an iPhone. Most of us have iPhones. I'm just kidding. iPhone users spell I, right? Question mark with a circle. I'm just kidding. And so why do you have an iPhone? If you're 17 and don't have a job, you have an iPhone because your parents want to know where you are, right? If the reason you have an iPhone, the reason you have access to information is because you were not born in 1895. And we forget that. And we think that somehow we're better or smarter or more advanced because we have these things, without realizing that we have the things we have today because of all the things that happened behind them. There's a quote that I was reading some history, mainly from going to London, just kind of being intrigued by some things that are happening in our culture. You read that all the crazy stuff that we have in our culture is really not that new. It's been happening generation after generation after generation. We just think, oh my gosh, this is unprecedented in the history of the world. It's only because the history of the world, in our perspective, is about 25 years. We have very short attention spans. Someone said one time, if you don't have 3 years of history, 3,000 years of history at your disposal, you're living hand to mouth culturally. 3,000 years. Most of us can't even figure out what happened in the 1700s. And this is what Bernand of Chartres wrote in the 12th century, He said, if we see more and further than they, speaking of the generations behind him, if we see more and further than they, it is not because of our own clear eyes or tall bodies, but it is because we are raised on high by their gigantic stature. It's an awareness that we are where we are today because of the things, better or worse, that happened behind us. I remember I was meeting with a guy, a friend of mine. His father was a pastor in this city in Wilmington 50 years ago. And Port City had just started, and this man was at the end of his life. And I asked if I could go see him, and I went and saw him and just asked him about the church that he led back in the 60s and 70s. And as we talked about this at the end, he talked about Port City, and he was very grateful for Port City. Mike, I love what God's doing at Port City. And I just said to him, thank you. Thank you, because I'm sure that you took a lot of shots, a lot of pot shots that I didn't have to take that allowed us to do things that we were doing in the early 2000 that you did back in the 60s and 70s that made it possible for us to do these things without the same level of criticism or the same level of difficulty, because you paved the way for us. It's having an awareness that what your parents have done, for better or worse, what our generations behind us have done, better or worse, have allowed us the perspective that we have. It allows us to make judgments about how we're going forward, but it's this perspective that is critical to understand, because it's about the redemption of legacy. You see, what has happened to us is not only do we not understand the past, but we sort of lose the future in the process. I mean, think about this. We have more opportunities to do more things. I mean, I'll talk to my kids. My kids have been in other parts of the world. I never left Georgia except to go to Panama City Beach. I mean, right? Tell me about that. Talk about culture. Right? Our kids, they have more opportunities. We have more opportunities at our fingertips today, and we have less respect and appreciation for them. And listen, it's easy to go, those millennials, this ain't a millennial problem. This is a culture problem. It's because we have fundamentally lost our perspective. We have more information and less understanding. We have access to more people and fewer connections. It says that kids are coming into college more academically prepared and less emotionally stable. We've lost our way. It's a culturally bankrupt culture because we don't understand relationships. We don't understand the other parts of this that all these things are critical for the redemption of. It's interesting, we observe even now, one of my premises in this series is that we as a culture do not understand marriage, have a fundamental understanding of marriage, or a fundamental understanding of sex or sexuality. The headlines of the last 2 weeks confirm that. The sexual harassment, all the stuff that's happening in our culture only reveal the fact that we really don't understand the purpose or power or meaning of sex and sexuality. And here's the thing, this is happening in a generation that was not raised on pornography. You fast forward this 10 and 15 years, and guess what's going to happen? You start to see that, and here's the beauty of this. This is not like, oh, let's just bash culture. Redemption of identity, of authority, and of legacy not only provide the way to change the course of who we are as people, but I believe it also provides the hope for a radical restoration. One of my favorite pictures in the Bible, in the book of Joel, God had punished his people, and the locusts came with this. The locusts came and ate all the harvest, destroyed the harvest. And as God is restoring this, this is what he tells them through the prophet Joel. He says, the years the locusts have stolen, I have restored. The power of redemption is more sweeping than you can know, even in your life. It's more hopeful than you know, and it's more available than perhaps you know. And that's what I want for us to look at. I want you to believe some things with me over the next few minutes together. When I read the Bible, what I see are things like this. We're just gonna read a couple of passages, one in the book of Ephesians and the other in the book of Hebrews. And I want us to just make some observations, because we're talking about this idea that the family is not just the parts of the church that allow us to have family ministries and do cool things and empower. You know, it's actually the components that make up the bigger thing. And I want you to see this. Listen to this. He's talking about the fact that Jesus came and he transferred you and me, if you believe in, if you're in him, from the domain of darkness into the kingdom of light. He moved you from one identity into another identity. And he says, consequently, because of that, you are no longer foreigners or strangers, but you are fellow citizens in God's household, or fellow citizens with God's people and members of his household. Now, I circled that word because it's talking about household. The people in my household are my wife and my two kids. They're in my household. Everybody else, not so much. Then he says this, built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. So he starts to talk about that we're building on something that we got before us with Jesus Christ himself as the chief cornerstone. He invites us to build on something. So you begin to see this imagery of St. Paul's cathedral, right? Are you with me? We're starting to see there's imagery of this. Then he goes on, he says this in the next verse. In him, the whole building is being joined together and it rises to become a holy temple. And in him, you too are being built together to become a dwelling place by which God lives. Back it up one verse. Look at this verse 21. In him, the whole body is joined together and it rises to become a holy temple. In Christ, all of these parts, your family and my family, as dysfunctional as they may be, are coming together and they're building this thing. They're the parts of this bigger thing. You keep reading and it says, in him, you too are becoming, are being built together to become this dwelling place in which God lives. If you flip over and you look in Hebrews chapter 3, you'll see more of this language. Chapter 3, verse 3 through 6. Jesus has been found worthy of greater honor than Moses, just as the builder of the house is greater than the house itself. I studied architecture. I'd studied Christopher Wren. I walked into St. Paul's Cathedral and I thought, this is Christopher Wren's building, right? This is the building that he designed. The building is beautiful. Christopher Wren gets the glory. That's the picture. He says that this is the building gets greater, I mean, the designer gets better glory than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but God is the builder of everything. Moses was a faithful servant in all of God's house, bearing witness to what would be spoken about by God in the future. But Christ is faithful as the Son. So here's this relational language again. He's the Son. He's establishing something else over God's house. And look at this. And we are God's house. We, me and you, we are his house. Indeed, if indeed we hold firmly to our confidence and to the hope in which we glory. If you back up, you see this. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 11. Both the one who makes people holy, which is Jesus, that's what he's talking about, the one who makes people holy and the people who are made holy are of the same family. I began to realize that this idea that I'm so glad I'm part of the family of God with all these kooky people, cleansed by his blood, right? I began to realize it's not so far-fetched. It's actually his intention to put all these parts together to build something spectacular. The people look and go, oh, wow, who built that? Oh, it was Christ. And that's us. That's our job. That's what we do. And then he goes on. He says this. I love this. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters. Does anybody have someone in your family that you pretend like they're not in your family? That's what he's talking about. Jesus doesn't feel that way about me and you. He doesn't go, oh, I like Mike, but man, oh, not really claiming the other dude. It says he's not ashamed. He's not ashamed of what he's done for you. He's not ashamed of what his plans for you are. He's not ashamed to draw you to redemption. He's like fired up about it. He says, you're part of his family, right? And we're in it. And he's making this happen. We are all being built together. You see, when you read this, what you realize is the family is more. Family is more than me and my wife and my 2.5 kids and you and your wife or husband and 2.5 kids. It's more than that. It's all of us. And the way I defined this a few weeks ago, I talked about the fact that the family structure is established so that our children's children will know God as God. It's generational, it's mindset. When we lose that, we build cultures that don't understand, that don't have vision for the future, that leave us wanting and entitled. That's the problem. It's not a millennium problem. It's a vision problem. And he tells us when we see ourselves as a part of the children's children, the two generations behind us, that's our responsibility. That's what we focus on. It changes everything about the way we deal with the here and now. But the other thing I thought of is, what if the family was bigger? What if it was more? How would I define that? And here's what I believe. Everybody wants to coexist and to be one. Here's God's plan for it. The family is the unifying system by which we live as his people. As his people, our identity is no longer Ashcraft or Smith or Jones. I didn't mean to leave anybody out, but I don't have a lot of time. It is now we bear the name of Christ. The family is established so that we live as his people under his authority. Under his authority. Under his rule and his reign and for his purpose. That my will is no longer central. My preservation of my part is no longer central, but how my part fits into the other parts to make the thing that my part was designed to be a part of is what matters. Does that make sense? So if I had to say it, I'd say it like this in one sentence. The family is the unifying system. It's the unifying system. Everybody's looking for this. By which we live as his people, under his authority, and for his purposes. Let's look back at the end of that passage in Ephesians. Look what it says. It says, in him, the whole building is being joined together and it rises as a holy temple in the Lord. It's all future tense. It's happening, or present tense. It's happening. There's a state to be desired. It's happening. It says, in him, the whole building, you and I, all of our little pieces and parts, as messed up as you might think they are, they're coming in him, they're coming together and they're building something. Keep reading. I love this. It says, in him, you also, even as messed up as you also, like me also, right? In him, you also are being built together to become this place where God dwells. So what does redemption look like? See, this is all of us. This is you. You're sitting there going, but no. You don't understand what I've done. He says, no, in him, you also, even in your like, it's you. It's for you as well. And he's not even ashamed. So what I want for you to do, I want you to believe some things with me. And I want you to just don't, I don't know how that can happen. You don't understand my story. I just want you to go, what would it be like if I believed this with all of my heart? That when it comes to the redemption of identity, what has happened is Jesus has made me the very righteousness of himself. I am. I bear the righteousness, the full righteousness, the rightness, the whole part. Do you know how hard it is to believe? Do you know how hard it is to believe that what you've done or what you thought or what I've thought, that still is true for me today? But you know what happens when you believe that? You know what it does for this idea of redemption? How it moves forward? See, a lot of us, when we start thinking about what we've done or who we are, we start going, I wish I hadn't, and we start looking back with all this regret. And then we start trying to make it up or pay it back, and redemption is always in the future. To believe that you have been made right with God by Christ, and that you belong, that in him you are becoming this thing, it frees you from having to prove that you're worthy. Whew. How good would that feel? For you not have to prove that you matter or belong or have a place in this world or in his kingdom. It frees you from having to perform your way to get acceptance or to get approval or to get accolades. It frees you from all that. It means I'm not no longer judged on how good a message is or how bad a message is. None of that, it's freedom from that. What happens to us is then when you get that place, when you really understand, guess what? This is the beauty. You are free to come just like you are and to be changed because you already belong and he provides the belonging. So a lot of people come in here and they think, well, if they just knew this about me, then I wouldn't belong. And other people come in here and they say, well, I'm going to belong, but I'm not going to change. And neither one of those are true. You can't belong and not change, because we're becoming. The parts are being formed together to build this thing. And it's not this building or a building. It's this kingdom thing, this temple in which God himself dwells, which is me and you. We are his building. And to be free from those things is really important. But you can't come and think that I belong and I can't change or I won't change, because that's not belonging. To belong is to be formed, to change, to submit ourselves. That brings me to the second thing. How does authority, what happens to this? What do we believe here? What I believe here is that Jesus Christ has the power to give me authority to do his will. I want you to think about this. Because a lot of us are going, when we think about the authority that we have, the power of Christ, what does that look like? It means I'm free from striving to get my way or to force my will. I mean, think about that. Think about if you could walk into your office and not have to force your way. Or in a marriage. Some of you are going, my marriage is hanging by a thread and I just grab on. And you hear me say, what if you just let go and trusted God? You're going, well, you don't know the people in my family, or you don't know the people I'm working with. And maybe you don't know the power of God. When's the last time you really said, God, I'm gonna let you deal with this? This is not passive. We talked about that. This is about authority. This is about stepping into the place. Because some of you feel so bad about what you've done or what you've contributed to the next generation because you've been a part of your kids' problems. And so everything is like guilt parenting. Well, I feel bad because I got a divorce. I'm gonna give them a car and give them this and give them that, not hold them accountable for anything. And it's just, and God has given you authority. What about the authority over sin? What about the authority over sin? What about the authority that God provides power over sin in our lives? What is it like for you to believe it? That's what I'm talking about. I know it's happened. I know what it's like to struggle with temptation. I know what it's like to suffer with temptation. I know what it's like to have a thorn in my side that I say, God, take this away, take this away, take this away, and he does not do it. My struggle may not be your struggle, but I've prayed that prayer a million times. And what he does it for is to teach us that we have been given power over sin, even in our weakness, because his strength is made perfect when we find ourselves there. We can do it. Hey, how do you do this? We can talk about that later, but I'm asking you to believe this first. Because if I tell you how to do it, you're gonna say, I'm gonna try it and see if it works, and then I'll believe it if it doesn't. That's not faith. He's asking you to believe this first. When you learn this, here's the beauty of this. Then you begin to see there are opportunities for you to input, to give input, to contribute, to influence all around you right where you are. You may not be able to command your way because of your position, but you will have this subtle power to influence because he has given you that authority. It's called love, by the way. That's another series. And it's all his provision. It's all his provision. The last thing is legacy. And I love this one. And I love this one because the pressure really comes off here. To think about the fact that the redemption of legacy means that it's probably not in my lifetime. Do you know why we rush around so much most of the time? Because we're afraid that time is gonna run out and we're not gonna do everything that we were supposed to do. We're not gonna get everything or enjoy everything or experience everything or whatever. So we're rushing around trying to make sure. And then we turn around when we get that mindset, what we do to our kids is we go, our kids gotta have it too. Then we start panicking if our kids are not ready for Harvard education by the time they're 9 years old. We're like, oh my gosh, what's wrong with my kids? Because we're comparing them to this fantasy that we've created for ourselves. As though we don't have time. Why? Because we think it's on us. If you remember the two phrases, in him, you're being built. In him, you also are included. In him. It's not about you or me or our effort. And when I think about this, from a legacy standpoint, I am free from being defined by my achievements, my successes, or my failures. Think about how many people are afraid if they're not going to have done anything significant by the time they die? And how do they measure that significance? By how much money they made, by what kind of position they held? Forget that, man. What about what people say about you? What about the people that were around you? When we fail to see this, this is what we wind up with. I'm telling you, this frees you from being defined by your successes or your failures or having to compete with other people. I mean, Lord, let's think about what men do, particularly men. When you go and you meet someone, what's the first question? When you meet a group of men, what's the first question other men ask you? Right? You know what it is. What do you do? You want to really quell some conversation, just tell them you're a pastor. It's crickets. I mean, I guess unless you're like an astronaut who's walked on the moon, everybody, you know, it's like, that would be kind of cool. What did you do? I walked on the moon. Crickets then too. It's like, well, we don't have anything to add to that. But barring that, what we're usually doing is we're establishing a pecking order. We sort of live back in here and it just perpetuates, it just crumbles on itself. Over here, it just crumbles on itself. And when you are free from that, it frees you from the pressure of perfection and what it allows. And I want you to pay attention to this real carefully. It allows you to be patient and to enjoy things. Imagine if your kids didn't have to be Harvard ready by the time they were 9. How would that change the pace in which you do things? You see, what I've looked in my life, because there are times, and look, I'm 47. I'm young. I'm very young. Make sure this crypt isn't getting dug yet. But I already start thinking, because in 50 years, the odds are I won't be the pastor of this church. I could be. 97, I could get there. But more than likely, I won't be. I began to look back at all the folks on our staff, all the people in our church, and I realized that, man, that's where redemption is. That's where the fulfillment of God's purpose is. And then I realized that I don't have time to do any of those things because I got so much stuff to do right now. What I realize is because I'm trying to accomplish all this stuff in my time. And when I realize that my purpose, unless Jesus comes back, and he could do that, I guess that's possible, probable according to some of you, he's coming back tomorrow. Tweet that out. We get a lot of... Mike said, my purpose is a small part. My purpose is a small part. It's a detail, a block in St. Paul's Cathedral. And it could be a detail on the spire. It could be somewhere in the chapel. It could be underneath the floor. It could be in the crypt. I mean, who knows? My purpose is a small part of God's purpose that continues towards completion in the generations to come. Do you know how freeing that is? That the purposes that God has established for me are probably going to come to fruition long after I'm gone. And what I get to do is to invest in other people, to call out other people. That's how redemption gets done. You see, when we become so focused on our little part, me and my marriage, me and my kids, me and my lack of marriage, me and not having kids, me and my career, me and all these other things, we become parts. And maybe your part looks perfect. But if you don't understand how your part fits into the other part that it was designed to be a part of, what are you doing? Your frame is too small. Your view of the family is too small. So my question is this. I love my family. I'm as proud of my family as anything else I am in my life. And it's largely due to my wife and then probably my two kids. They probably have a lot more to do with me. But anyway, I'm very proud of them. But I realize that that's an incomplete part until I understand how that part becomes a part of what it was intended to be a part of, if that makes sense. So my question for you that I want you to wrestle with is, how does your part fit? You're going to scratch your head. Oh, how does it fit? It's in him. In him, he builds. In him, we belong. in him. I want for us to consider and say, God, how is it that we really become we and actually become the family of God? I mean, look around. This is a kooky family, isn't it? But yet we get to be a part of the thing that causes the whole world to look and wonder and go, wow, the builder of that is truly spectacular. Maybe we need a bigger view for our family. Let's pray together. God, I pray right now for our church. There's a lot of great churches, and we're just one part of that, but I do pray for our part. In all of our campuses, as we understand what it means to be a family, to work together, to be a part of your household, all the things that you've mentioned in your word. God, I ask that you would help us to see that more clearly, together. God, I pray for those who are here and their bricks are in tatters. They don't even think their brick matters, but yet it does. I ask that you would begin to do redemptive work in the lives of each of those parts, in the places where you know it needs. And I pray that it wouldn't happen because we work harder or try harder or do more, rather because we actually avail ourselves to your power and your authority, and that miracles would truly happen in some of the parts that need it desperately. God, and even the ones that are broken and feel they don't matter, that they would hear your words, that in Christ, they too are becoming a critical part of your work in this. God, I just ask that you would give us space and time to understand, to hear. God, that you would give us resolve to look around us and to think about the influence and the contribution we make to the culture, to the people around us. And Father, in doing so, we would begin to understand more fully how we actually become your family, a part of your family, the full expression of your household, all for your glory. And I pray this in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen.